Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing most every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they're broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content, as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. Today, it's an honor to present to you, for the hour, filmmaker, writer, and activist Elsa Rosbach. Ever since I first saw the film, The Killing Floor, at my friend Bill's place in Seattle sometime around 1988, naming the film has been routine for me anytime someone asks me where to start their political education, where to start unlearning the bullshit they learned in school and discovering what really happened. If you're going to read one book, read Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. And if you're going to watch one movie, watch The Killing Floor, about the events at and around the slaughterhouse that led up to what became known as the Chicago Race Riots of 1919. It was many years later, at a gig in Berlin, Germany, that I discovered that one of the folks in the room was the executive producer of my favorite film, which has since been just recently restored. As I found myself frequently sleeping in Elsa's guest room slash editing room on future visits to Berlin, I discovered much more of Elsa's work and learned a lot more about the many obstacles that can confront anyone trying to bring hidden history to the big or small screen. The restored version of The Killing Floor is currently available to watch via filmmovement.com, and hopefully when it's safe for the cinemas to open up again, we'll be able to see it on the big screen as well. Elsa Rosbach, I'm so glad you could join me for the hour. How's the pandemic treating you there? It must be just a bit of a bizarre experience being in a country with an actual functional government that's kind of taking, you know, getting things under control with the pandemic, and then watching what's happening in your home country, home state of Colorado, which is pretty disastrous. We could start with any transatlantic observations you have to make in terms of the widening gulf between the countries with functional governments and those and the failed states of the world.
Well, I think of course it's better that the healthcare system is better in Germany, and that's one reason I wound up staying here so long. I was a single mom when I came over. I was having difficulty making much of a living doing radical films in the U.S. But above all, we immediately had healthcare coverage, you know, even as U.S. citizens and so forth. However, it's a little bit exaggerated because my son is working in an emergency room. He's a doctor in the hospital here, and they are not all that well equipped. They are understaffed, all those things. And beyond that, a lot of my relatives live in California, in the Bay Area and LA, and they locked down right away. I thought they did a somewhat better job than almost any other state, except maybe New York later, but they did it earlier. And they're having a resurgence. So we don't feel totally safe in Germany also, that there could not be a resurgence here.
Right. Yeah. And of course here, I mean, it's kind of similar problems. Like Germany is also, there's also open borders all over the place. And here, even if one state does a fairly good job, then it doesn't really matter because there's the interstate highways. You know, I mean, apparently the outbreaks are happening along the highway routes, like I-95.
Yeah, well, they are going to be doing testing when you fly into Germany. at no cost to the passenger and upon arrival. But the tests, these immediate tests, may not always be accurate. You know, that's what they say anyway. You know, so it's better than nothing. But yeah, it is. Let's say, I think Germany is in many ways a more democratic country than the U.S. at this point. And it's kind of interesting for me because my father was German. He came to the U.S. in 1939. I always grew up with this feeling, dark and difficult Germany. And I lived here since the mid-90s when it became clear I couldn't make the rest of my labor series, history series, of which The Killing Floor was to be just one of 10 hopefully brilliant films. We got totally stonewalled on that. And so I came here. And for a long time, many friends wouldn't want to come visit me from the U.S.
Wow.
Because they were Jewish. Yeah. Because they just didn't want to step foot in Germany. And it was true somewhat. But now Germany, unfortunately, it's moving a little bit in the direction of France and other countries. We're trying to stop them from weaponizing drones. But an example really is that they have been more pacifistic and more peace-loving is that the majority of Germans are totally against weaponizing drones. Mm. Nevertheless, we may get them, which shows Germany is not a perfect democracy at all. You know, they're pushing to get them this year. I can't guarantee we won't have them. But it's been the longest of any great power in Europe and NATO member state not to take weapons for the drone. It's been in debate since 2012. They've been trying to get them, and the resistance has been too strong. So it's you come here often, David. You know, it's a pretty good.
Yeah, it's really quite a place. And it's also, I don't know, you know, a lot of people outside of Germany are not aware of the radical history of Berlin in terms of just recent decades. Like, I mean, recent, I mean, the past 50 years, 60 years, like in terms of the sort of fascinating social experiment of like anybody who didn't want to join the army could just move to West Berlin. And so you ended up with, I mean, for that and so many other reasons, you ended up with a city full of radicals, and you were there at pretty much the peak radicalism, I'd say, in Berlin. You went to film school in Berlin in the late 60s. Is that right?
That's right. Before that, I studied philosophy and all at the FU Berlin. I grew up in Denver, not speaking German. It's still a hindrance for me here. I still have an accent, although I try to make the best use of it. But just because I'm an American and
I'm a foreigner,
or whatever, yeah. You know,
you can still play the foreigner card if you got an accent.
Yeah, they like to talk to American critics of the government better than they like to talk with German critics of the government, you know. But I'm talking about in the parliament and things like that. But right. For lobbying and whatever. But I came here. I went to Smith College in Massachusetts on a scholarship, and then I got another scholarship to come here. And everything was paid for. Again, one of these things. Also, my son's medical school, he went here, was all free. Okay, just Americans. This is normal in a cultivated, rich country to do this. But in any case, yes. And so I was there then at 68, 1968 exactly, was when I started my film studies, and I was there till 72. But a lot of the time, I and other students were hardly there because
you were demonstrating against one thing or another, the Vietnam War.
No, not just demonstrating. You know, we used to have two giant military bases here in Berlin, and the soldiers were flying in and out to Vietnam. We had quite a lot of race conflict also on the bases. You know, the bases were kind of divided between the bros and you know, the black African Americans, and they had one dance place where we went. Then the others, then there were the ones who smoked pot, the mainly white, and then the ones who drank beer, also white. You know, so that was how it was. And so we had a GI newspaper, in which I was part of, lucky to be part of. And I know that I and many others at the Film Academy didn't come that often, and a couple of my friends joined the Red Army Fraction. They were brilliant filmmakers, both of them, and they were killed in that. You know, so yeah.
What were the circumstances when they were killed? There were a number of different actions, and I don't know how many people in the RAF were killed during that time. But
well, I don't know exactly, but I do know Holger Mainz was the name of the fantastic cameraman at the Film Academy. He was about a year ahead of me and so forth. And he joined the real Bader-Meinhof group. He was in their inner group, and he went to that big prison in Stuttgart, and he actually died from a hunger strike there. Yeah. And the other one was named Philip Sauber, and he was killed somehow in the shootout, but I didn't follow that quite as much. But a friend of mine was married to him, you know, so yeah, she actually wrote a book about it, which unfortunately I've never read in detail, but yeah.
Life is too full to read all the books.
Factories, we were making, this was my inspiration to start doing this kind of work in the US. We made the fashion in the Film Academy was to make films about workers. The German 68 movement discovered three things. America was not all that great. You know, America was also a war criminal, or the US, I should say, not America. They discovered that there were still many Nazis in high positions, and there was a campaign against that. And they rediscovered the whole communist movement, the working class, the films that had been made in the Soviet Union, the work of Bertolt Brecht, and making films about labor was kind of a fashion. So the first film I ever shot in the Film Academy, because I did camera there too as well, and actually I was one of the filmmakers on the killing floor as well. I was the co-writer. I wrote the story. I was actually the producer. I had the title executive producer because it was for a labor series for TV, but I was there more the on hands also. But I shot in a factory, an Osram light bulb factory, and just shot, even looking at them work for 2 minutes is dizzying. Because they do the same thing over and over again so many times in 2 minutes that you know, you just say, how can anyone stand
it? How can
it?
They survive?
So I got interested in it. I did another film though, initially a feminist spoof of Clara Zetkin's Visit. She was a great socialist and part of the SPD, who then became part of the Communist Party, and a great friend of Rosa Luxemburg, and she was supposed to take over the women's work for the Third International, and she met with Lenin. And the only thing Lenin never, of course, I loved Lenin back then, but he never, one thing I didn't like, he didn't write a single text about women and women's rights or anything, you know, so, which was more in the tradition of the German social democrats. So, so anyway, it's a kind of ironic send up of their meeting, you know, from the actual text of the Clara Zetkin wrote about this meeting. Yeah. So, yeah.
Elsa, in light of
too much detail, we need to talk about something else.
Well, I want to talk about the killing floor. I mean, in light of, first of all, of course, it, you know, as people need to know, it is available right here locally in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater. If you want to support the Clinton Street Theater, you can watch it on their section of filmmovement.com. But if you go to filmmovement.com, and you search for The Killing Floor, you'll find that you can watch it there online in the restored version of it. And the film, I mean, it's it takes on, so it's such a fantastic film. The acting, the script, everything about it, and I mean, it's amazing. And the way it takes on issues of race and class, and the labor movement, and using race and racism as a tool to divide the working class, and it takes on so many layers of the reality of America in 1919, and I'm not sure how much it's changed. And in light of recent events going on all over the streets of the country, it seems like, despite the pandemic, the timing of re-releasing this film really couldn't be better.
Well, I have to say that, I mean, sometimes I feel I should have done this sooner, but it was very difficult. But I was finally able to convince someone to pay for this, which was UCLA Film and Television Archive, which had the film. The film won an award at Sundance Film Festival. It was on TV first, and then very unusually, it crossed over to be recognized as an independent film. It was on American Playhouse in 1984. And then it would run, was it Cannes in 1985, many other festivals, they won an award at Sundance. So it was in the Sundance archives, but it's very expensive to restore, you know, a film and go to 60 millimeter, the negatives, and scan every frame in 4K and so forth. But I did convince them because it was the 100th anniversary of the race riots in 2019. And so they sprang for at least most of the cost. My company had to pay a bit. And then it was shown in November also at the Siskel Film Theater. And then it was in a couple of other places like Madison. And then after the beginning of March, it was closed down. And it was, you know, no more screenings. I wrote, I said, are there, could you want to make a book? No, I didn't quite catch the first rung of this virtual cinema. But what happened was in the first week of June, I was somehow inspired from all that I'm seeing on TV about the protests. And I feel historically for the first time in my lifetime that so many whites are supporting it. And according to the surveys, you know, a large majority, I don't know how far they'll really want to go, you know, but that's really, and so I felt that I wrote a letter to a festival director and also the distributor, this film speaks to this historic moment. And it was not, it was actually so much in Chicago 2019, the way it was in Minneapolis in 2020, all the same things, and the National Guard coming and whatever, and the worst, most under, these were meatpacking or slaughterhouse workers in Chicago. They have suffered also the most, you know,
yeah, in ways today, all over the country. And it was still just, today, you know, 87, I heard a statistic, 87% of slaughterhouse workers in the United States are people of color today.
Yeah, yeah, but you know what I read, interestingly enough, because I want to get the distributor to put out a Spanish version. I'm looking up data to back this. The slaughterhouses now are about 50% Latino.
Yes.
And they are playing the same role that the African-American workers were playing in the 2019 as the potential strike breakers, but maybe workers. And the African-American or the black and white workers are all union members, but the Latino.
A new dynamic using Latino, the undocumented aspect to, to divide.
So it does speak to this moment, and it has been taken on really well. It's showing in 23 cinemas around the U.S. It's gotten the most outstanding artistic reviews that it's ever gotten, you know, and from different reviewers, and as you had always seen it, David, but others perhaps had not, but as in fact a really path-breaking work, both in terms of historical drama in cinema and in terms of the history that it tells, and how we base it also on accuracy. This is not a fictional story. This was researched carefully. All of the main characters were researched from documents in the National Archives and the U.S. Labor Department. There was at that time, 1919 and 1920, they were under federal oversight because there had been the war. So any dispute was heard by a federal judge, Judge Altshuler, who's also in the film. And I found a site in William Tuttle's book, Professor William Tuttle's, about the Chicago race riot, a footnote. And one black worker is shouting at the other in front of this white judge, you know, fuck you, basically. And I was curious about it. So I looked, got the whole transcript. And there you see that the race riot was not just black against white or white primarily against black. It was a white supremacist race riot. But there were conflicts among the blacks also about cooperating with the whites, building a movement together with them where they still felt that they might not have be able to play a full role, or they might have to play take on new bosses in this other movement, in essence. And also, of course, many white workers that struggled and actually gave up trying to grab things. They were really committed to winning the African-American workers. They knew they could never build a strong movement without that. And so they actually lost that struggle in 2019. But they built the
building. In 1919?
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. My gosh. Mm-hmm. Thank you, David. Okay. Mm-hmm. 1919. But the you see in the film how the networks between the black and the white workers are built. The activists are committed. And in 15 years later or so, they built the most anti-racist union in the USA and in the CIO. And the United Packing House Workers stood as real monument and was also marching with Martin Luther King. I mean, it was a very, you might recall also was, well, you know very well, was assassinated
while organizing a big multiracial movement.
Yeah. It was multiracial and Martin Luther King was close to the labor movement and they were close to the civil rights movement. Yeah, that's it.
Despite the fact that so many of the best organizers were kicked out of the labor movement after the Second World War, right? And then we have fast forward to the 80s and you finally, after getting this project out on the screen, which of course, you know, people who aren't following, who don't know the backstory, like me when I saw it at the time, of course, you have no idea just how much effort is involved and how many years of research and how much fundraising just to get one film put out. And it makes you realize how many films don't get made. And then in your case, we have very specific examples of 9 more films that have not been made, for which you've already written stories and done loads of research. And it was supposed to be, as you mentioned, a 10-part series. And I think it is so fascinating and says so much about the state of affairs here in the U.S. that at that time, PBS, the public, so-called public broadcaster here in the U.S., would not decide. There was a decision by management there of PBS that they would not take money from unions. They take money from corporations all the time, but they would not take money from unions to help fund a series of films about the labor movement.
Well, actually, it's true that it took a long time, the research, and there were issues also. The public television itself was not unionized, and that was posing a problem for the main funder, which was the National Endowment for Humanities in Washington. You know, it was like,
wow.
And you have to realize that in the background, the labor movement had done the lobbying work to secure the financing for the National Endowment for Humanities and the Arts and for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. So they were, and this is one reason I got so much support for a series set in history. It was only when it was going to go from 1840s till 1940s, the first American industrialization and the winning of the first major labor rights. So it wasn't contemporarily controversial necessarily, but even WGBH could not, you know, they sent me around to Mobil Oil and all this, and to get them, you have to have private sector matching money. It's required. And it's always said that's really normally corporate money. So basically you have R&D by the government, very expensive in my part case for a 10-part series with tons of historians and researchers and 3 full screen plays actually written, and which we had to submit to NEH and budgets and location research and everything ready to go, as it were. The public television wouldn't allow for about 2 or 3 years the labor financing, because they said this would be advertising for the unions, you know, and that you can't have a sponsored thing. The police can't make a film about police on public television. So we went to the New York Times. It was in February 1980. And I didn't even know any labor people really well at that time. I didn't come from a labor family myself. I had an interview in the New York Times. And it was a big headline. It became a national story. PBS bars unions from funding labor series. And I went down to Bal Harbour, where all of the people, the union heavyweights, were gathered around the pool for their convention. And they adopted me, basically. You know, this article had said there was going to be up to 4 million from labor, but we didn't know that at all at the time. But when we came back, so they did allow it. They were forced to by this public of debate. When it came to do the next film, which actually The Killing Floor was directed by Bill Duke. It was his first feature film, African-American director who's of quite a lot of note in since then in Hollywood, Deep Cover and other ones, Sister Act and different films that he's made. A lot of people, because people were working to also, there was still not enough money, and the unions and the Screen Actors Guild and all of the unions, including the Teamsters, did extremely special waivers that we didn't have to pay the full union rate, but it was still all union. They're all thanked profusely at the end of the film and the dozens of credits that go by. And many others got their start there, and many took the job at the lower rate because they were getting started, you know, and became famous later as a production designer, as a costume designer in Hollywood. I wanted to make the next film as a director, you know, and it was about the young women of the Lowell Mills. It was ready to go, but public television pulled out of it, you know, and although they initially said they would support it. The NEH supported it, but you have to realize that Lynn Cheney, the wife of Dick Cheney, the vice president, became the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities about 1986, and remained well into the Clinton era.
Yeah. That. So, if anybody thinks the Trump family invented nepotism, think again.
So the fact is, though, that the atmosphere changed, you know, during the 70s and as then Reagan rolled in. But for all of the labor support, this became the project that they hoped would get made, the whole series, you know, and so they helped fund the pilot a big time, really. And that's because they saw this as one way to fight back on all the slander and the incredible campaign to destroy the labor movement that Reagan was embarking on. And that he carried through extremely successfully, actually.
An important way to fight back, but such a difficult way to fight back. I mean, as you discovered, there's so much propaganda for corporations and for the founding fathers and the glories of American capitalism, and you know those films get made all the time. But making a film like The Killing Floor is just a far more rare and difficult undertaking. Although the hidden history, I've always thought since I was quite young, the hidden history of the country, these kinds of incidents like the ones that you flesh out in that movie are so exciting and have such incredible potential as really exciting blockbusters in my view. I mean, it seems like it could be, right? But they just don't get it.
They are terrific stories. I mean, one of the films that was in the 10-part series plan, which incidentally, guys, if you want to see more, anyone who wants to know more about this labor history series and wants to see also the incredible reviews we've been getting or have gotten sometimes in the past and where it's all playing, go to the website of filmmovement.com and just search The Killing Floor. It's right up near the top. And you'll see that. You'll see details in the press kit about how the whole film was made. The outstanding African-American talent that we had for the screenplay, Leslie Lee, Obie Award-winning playwright, Ron Milner, one of the great all-time African-American playwrights, both unfortunately deceased. The pioneering African-American editor, John Carter, who also is unfortunately deceased in 2018, but who was the first African-American to get into the cinematography, something or whatever. Music by Liz Suedos. It's actually, you can see over there also, if you look under discussion guide, you won't think to look there. You'll see the plan of this whole series with each story on one page. And you'll see how much support it had, how many historians, and also that it appeared to have the whole support of public television behind it. Although there were divisions, obviously, as we said, between those who would have wanted to launch it, we hope. But my film has been brought out also that was about the Lowell Mill Girls. And the main supporter in public television had been WGBH. But that film actually is set in the Lowell Mills. And Lowell it was the founder and one of the main movers and shakers in WGBH. So no one is No one is neutral when you come to labor in the U.S. Neither the corporations,
the owners of the union, of the Lowell of industry in Lowell, some of the founders of the PBS, yeah. Which is what. So, but yeah, and this is what it comes down to. Or I mean, because one of your experiences, it seems pretty clearly for whatever complex of reasons, is in the 80s, as difficult as it was and is now to make films that have real radical history commentary, it's even harder to make films about the labor movement than it is to make films about modern day and historic racism. Would you say? I mean, and there's a lot of overlap, of course, between the labor movement and racism. And I don't mean to separate these things, but they are both sort of, to the extent that they're separate issues, it's a lot harder to do labor films than it is to do films related to race.
That's right. The obstacles are greater. I mean, one of the films it really inspired me as a film student was Salt of the Earth, you know, and I remember reading all the things, and it's interesting to read the book by the producer, Herbert Biberman, and how that film was blockaded also by the IATSE union in the laboratories, and they wouldn't project it in the U.S. It was a story about Hispanic mine workers in New Mexico, and part of the union who had been who had left the CIO, they were blacklisted basically as communists and with communist writers and all. And I thought, oh, this is the kind of film I might want to make, but it will never happen again that you could go through all this, you know, and so forth. But
it's another film I think of in the same breath as Killing Floor. And I often tell people about Salt of the Earth. I mean, it, like Killing Floor, it just like fleshes out race, class, and gender so brilliantly, and all the overlap and the conflicts within the whole community around these questions. Yeah.
So we have the stories in the movement. You know, what's interesting also is that labor actually trusted me. Although I had talked to many communists, you know, the great African-American Charles Hayes of the United Packing House Workers, Jesse Proston, you know, others. I met with them personally. Also, as I started, I met with Howard Zinn also, you know, and I was starting. And so I was inspired by these stories, and I had the same feeling you. They ought to be made. They're full of drama, entertainment, and they're also our real history. You know, as Howard Zinn also said, the people's history. You know, and it's true that the response to racism after the 60s in the cultural world was to come down on the side of identity politics. That is to say, the solution is to have more African American editors and directors, writers, and to have black films and so forth. There was, however, a tension always between identity politics and class politics. This is also the tension of the African American workers in the slaughterhouses in Chicago in 2019. And our main character comes down
in 1919.
He comes down on the end. I won't tell you which side he comes down on.
Right. No, people have to see the film. Can't spoil that amazing ending.
This class story is more difficult. It's more easy to tell in Great Britain, even. You know, you have filmmakers like Ken Loach and all. There's never been a Ken Loach emerge, really, a U.S. Ken Loach, you know.
I've heard that Ken Loach gets much of this funding from the French government. Is that true? Do you know? I mean,
But I do know the sources. The sources of funding are an issue because nothing is usually clean source of funding. The unions did not look at the screenplays. They left me that freedom. The corporations, I'm not sure they would have if they had come in. Two did come in, but it was through the help of labor, Xerox and American Home Products Corporation, but with smaller grants, not like the real sponsorship like they do usually. But we see even the institutions like WGBH have their own histories that relate to labor. And it's going to be true of every distribution thing that you have. So it's great how the streaming and frees up distribution. Although I hope people will see it in the big screen because it's so spectacular. It really looks amazing. It's of a quality like even though it was 60 millimeter, it looks like fine quality 35 millimeter, but in the old fashioned ratio 5 to 4. But
That aspect of producing music and films, I mean, at least for, as a musician, I can say it's very frustrating that even though stuff is so much more easily available when it comes to both films and music than ever before, the quality is, I mean, people are listening through their phones and, you know, watching on their phones. And even if they have access to a bigger screen, like my teenage daughter, she prefers to see everything on this little phone. And I mean, the quality is just, you know, lost.
And it's a pretty complex story. It's actually easier to absorb the whole story also watching on the big screen, I found. You know,
So we are talking with Elsa Rosbach on Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, most Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays every week, along with the other broadcasts I host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. All of these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, Cable Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovics and on Patreon at patreon.com/davidrovics. And in podcast form, if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. Also, it looks like you're in the final stages of producing that film that you've been working on for a very long time, which I'm really looking forward to seeing, about your father, who was involved in one of the plots to kill Hitler
I'll say a little bit more about this film. I'm hoping The Killing Floor will lead. I was supposed to direct. I had the wonderful Polish director Agnieszka Holland as my directing mentor for my first film. It was supposed to be a directorial debut as a feature film, which I've never been able to do. And I was able to get it refinanced by through the thing that was headed by the 20-year, then later head of the Berlin Film Festival. But the German company went bankrupt. And that was in 2002. I still have the rights, but I got very involved with peace activity after 2003 and have made some peace videos you might find interesting. We Were Soldiers in the War on Terror, that's available for Amazon. And so, but I spent and do spend even now a lot of my time on this. So I'm hoping actually that there might even be interest in, I figure even the series was called Made in USA. Trump should really finance this, right? I don't know, with a title like that. I'm just on the side.
But maybe if he just sees the title. Like
going to the other film, I did explore and filmed over a, it's getting light. The sun is shining.
Yeah, the sun moved there. It's sun,
yeah, sunset I can move in Berlin. A little bit too much. Yeah, I didn't realize this would happen. So, let me move over here a little bit more. That's okay. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Better? Okay.
This is live.
I guess so. It just came from my window.
And these things even happen on like the big networks these days with everybody being home for the pandemic. You know, we're getting a lot of very good bookshelves and kitchen backgrounds.
I the sun shines in this spot right during this. I started, I was very burdened by the fact that my father was in Hitler Youth, and although he came to the States in 39, he left Germany in 38, so he wasn't involved with all the major war crimes, the worst ones. My grandfather had remained a corporate director here. My grandfather was originally a German-American, it's a long story. You'll have to see the film to get it all. He was considered by my mother's side of the family in Colorado, where I grew up, to be a total Nazi and a war criminal. And I only discovered after I was 40 and after he was deceased. I used to visit them and all. At one point, he took me on a walk about, 1970 in Stuttgart. And he said, we the corporations supported Hitler and it was a mistake, and sort of like that. But only in the 1980s, through someone who worked in the family, did I learn that he had been a close friend and supporter of Karl Gerdler. And Karl Gerdler was a conservative German. He had been the mayor of Leipzig, but he refused. He stepped down from his office when the Nazis tore down the statue of the Jewish composer Mendelssohn, and he couldn't get it reinstated. And he took a job that my grandfather provided for him, actually, in the Bosch firm. And the Bosch firm is one of the only firms, it's also in the museum here of the resistance. It's acknowledged that they did play a role in the resistance. And I also know that they have and have seen something in Yad Vashem for the director of the Bosch firm. Later, after Robert Bosch had died, his name is Waltz. And so it's somewhat recognized, but I only learned about it then, and it was a revelation. And my family was worried. My grandmother, a German grandmother at that time, from whom I have this name, Elsa, she was worried. She said, there's still Nazis around. You know, I guess they were worried about their Bosch pension and everything. Don't look into it. But I still did. And I started then shooting with my father in the 1990s. And as my son was young and was doing like one of those autobiographical home video things that became very popular also in the 1990s. And I received some financing to develop it. I used it all, also a lot of it to shoot, but collected tons of documents researching the story. And it was a gray zone. You know, however many documents you could look into, you can't really tell, because they didn't write the real stuff down at that time. You know, how much my question in the film was, grandfather, were you a resistance fighter or a Nazi? Now, my father didn't actually have the answer on that, because people who were in the resistance or not, they would just say, I think Hitler is crazy or something. And if the kid said that somewhere to someone else, then everyone would be in trouble. But they wouldn't tell their kid, hey, I'm involved in this resistance movement and so forth, you know. And so he really didn't know all that much. And but I kept filming, and the film has become an autobiographical film of me pushing to know the story, maybe somewhat neurotically even, because I'm German-American, what is the family guilt and all. My father is trying to answer. He's kind of honored that I find him so interesting and what he has to say. But actually, he's headed toward his death. He has a stroke. I filmed him right from when he was quite healthy in 1994. He was 75, building a huge house outside the hills of Colorado, in the hills of Colorado. And he actually never completed this house. You know, it was sold for like whatever after he died. And it was supposed to reestablish his roots somehow in the U.S. When he died, he asked to have his ashes returned to the family grave in Berlin, which I did. It was, and I filmed all the way right through, and my son growing up from being, and me from a pretty young woman still in my 40s, it looked like that way anyway, and till into my middle age and not quite my old age, but I'm editing it like a dramatic film. In other words, I only had one camera at all times. Sometimes I shot myself, sometimes I had fairly established or even famous camera people. It was all shot on digital, and I've now edited about 4 hours of this in scenes. Of course, I don't expect it to all be 4 hours, but it's kind of material. You have to edit it to see how well the scene works, and you'll see which are the best scenes. Yes, I hope to finish this in the next couple of years, and I will seek, it will need post-production funding and cost, editing costs covered. And I think it's very unusual because it's told from an American perspective in a way, and it's German, and it has German and American, but American. And it's kind of the roots of where I came to so much motivation, which people don't understand sometimes. How could you spend, you know, 10, 20 years trying to tell labor history, which is censored by these institutions, not like Russia might censor, but through the lack of support for telling these stories. And why would you now take another story, you know, like this one about my grandfather, and spend all these years doing this? I do shorter activist films. Some of them you can find also in Palestine. I shot in Gaza and different things. I do them in German and English, depending on what the situation is, or sometimes in English with German subtitles or whatever. But I feel that I was psychologically very motivated as a young child to somehow bring together these two parents, one German, one not trusting what the U.S. was saying in their broadcasting, and secretly having to listened in the basement to the German broadcast, which was kind of illegal. He could have been, and also when he went to MIT, being watched by the FBI, them collecting all sorts of documents on him because he was going on a skiing trip, and they said, "Oh, the German bought film material and stuff like that." And so this was kind of like the secret wait, and seeing how the U.S. is turning into, or has taken on. Not the population. I'm so thrilled that the population is standing up, is out in the streets on racism. And guys, we also have to rebuild the labor movement. Otherwise, we will have nothing, you know. And it's a harder row to toe, actually, than to just fight against racism. I shouldn't say just. It's part of fighting against racism. The most disadvantaged workers are Black and brown workers. But it is a part of reestablishing, really, democracy.
You know, I think more and more of those connections are being made. You know, you hear so much more of the if-then statements. If Black Lives Matter, then how about affordable housing? Yeah. If Black Lives Matter, how about minimum wage and, you know, how about health care? How about, you know, so that's, yeah. Of course, it needs to go into real sort of, you know, movement organizing. But Elsa, yeah, I wonder also.
Very hard. You get more easily token things on the Black thing, on the labor right? thing. It's going to be tooth and nail.
You know? Yeah, because we're talking about real measurable victories with labor, right? It's right. Not about your internal bias. It's about actual wages and actual right. Conditions of work and actual, you know, housing and that kind of yeah. thing.
And the labor movement was, as you mentioned, tremendously weakened in the McCarthy era. But we have now had a 40-year downhill and since Reagan was elected. And we need to reverse that. But I'm watching it. I just want to say, on CNN and on Democracy Now and so forth all the time here in Germany and yeah. sort of living in both countries at the same time in that respect. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. as you are watching what's going on here and also not just, the uprising, the pandemic, but also for 4 years now, the rise of Trump and what it, you know, many people are characterizing as a sort of neo-fascist or wannabe fascist movement, and you're doing this film about your dad and his youth, and you must have a lot of frequent thoughts, if not necessarily conclusions, I don't know, about what's going on here in terms of the rise of a potential fascist takeover. Do you think there's going to be an election in November?
I don't know. And I actually asked that question, or if there is one, will it be honored? And if it's even not, a dishonest election that's been manipulated by, you know, the Trump forces and all. And I remember, because I always felt a little sad when people were saying the Germans are this and they're all Germans are, you know, the collective guilt thing. You know, the Germans, including even the corporate resistance and the military resistance that ultimately emerged, they paid the price of their lives. My grandfather did not, but he paid the price of having a total nervous breakdown that lasted for over 20 years, where he could not even practically say his name, you know, from being a brilliant corporate leader and engineer, whatever, but that is a German international marketing guy. And he also was responsible for developing television, which was the precursor of the technology for drones and was a weapon that Hitler invested in more than atomic weapons, actually, you know, because they were doing also unmanned flights with the V2 and all. It was the precursor. That's the U.S. wanted to grab that, you know, the Soviets also at the time, of course. That technology.
The U.S. got Wernher von Braun.
And they got it, yeah. The Wernher von Braun, regarded as a terrible war criminal here. I remember as a kid seeing in the 50s how he was feted in Scientific American. But the thing is that many Germans paid the price. And this has also not been told. Schindler's List was told, a nice corporate guy. But has the story of the communist resistance and the socialist resistance been told in the concentration camps, in the whatever, flying people who were safe in Russia, flying back, parachuting back to be in the resistance and then being killed a year later. You know, they have done risk more than we have ever had to risk in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope we don't have to get ready for something like that. And when it comes to that, then you see the gray zone of how I see my grandfather now, or my grandmother always saying she was against him being in the resistance. My German grandmother, do you want to be killed? You know, the questions in every family, how far they will go with the resistance. Is it even ethical to their own family, their own children to do so? All these things, I hope we don't come to that. I'm so proud of what people are doing in Portland and all around the U.S. since the end of May. I'm just really proud of it. Again, not just I have said, I know that Noam Chomsky has also said, it's a turn in the U.S. that we have not seen since. So let's take on now the issue of labor as well and class oppression. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's often talked about of recent events. I mean, of course, in so many ways, it's unprecedented because of the confluence of the various factors going on with the pandemic and the uprising. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of various associations that many people make between the current moment and historical moments that some of us are. Maybe, you know, have either read about or are old enough to have experienced. And I don't know if do you often get reminded of anything in particular that you've lived through or not?
I want to make a comment on that. There was like a group that started Refuse Fascism. I follow all these things, and some of them come to Europe, even that movement did. I think it's a mistake to call it fascism. It's too early.
Right?
Fascism is much worse than what we're even seeing in the U.S. now. We're seeing how it could go if the federal government under someone like Trump was actually able to defeat the police and the people in all these cities. You know what? I don't think he has that power, to be honest. You know, but the corporations have a tremendous power. Some of them also, as in Germany, may, you know, be against him, actually, some for. We have to use this moment, if we can overcome Trump, and if there is an election for Biden, you know, who is not my favorite candidate of the Democrats, but in 2016, I didn't even vote, lesser evil, I voted for Jill Stein, but okay. You know, we don't know what kind of leadership we're going to have there, but we need to bring the ball back. We have to make our goal is not just to defeat Trump. The goal is to reverse everything that's happened since the McCarthy era.
Mm-hmm.
To use the momentum, if we win, to push it that far. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good goal. Bring back the New Deal.
Yeah, right. Well, and
there's a lot. It's a lot of talk. I mean, the thing is.
Yeah,
it's being talked about a lot. I mean, the mainstream conversation is now. I mean, universal healthcare isn't necessarily being supported by Biden, but it is very popular and a mainstream idea much more now than it was 6 months ago, and that's true of so many other things. I mean,
Will Biden come out and say and stand on the post office steps in different towns around the U.S. and say, "I want you to join a union"? You know, will he do that? I mean, will
no way, no way.
That's what FDR did, and FDR right? was a bourgeois guy. He didn't let the Jews in. He was, you know, he did hire a lot of communists, but he kind of, you know, I don't know if he kept them on an equal basis with everyone else necessarily. I mean, but this is what we need. This is what we have to push for. You know, yeah. Sanders would do that, of course, but would have done that had he, but. So I don't know, there's a choice of vice president. Who do you think is the most?
I mean, the vice president's, you know, I mean, maybe he's old enough that the vice president will end up having more influence than they usually do, but they don't usually seem to play much of a prominent role. You know, I mean, it seems so often they're just there for looks, although maybe in George W. Bush's case, it was a bit different, but it was kind of more behind the scenes that Cheney was running the show, I suspect, you know, rather than like, I don't know what personally, whether it is going to make much of a difference either way, because it seems to me that one of the parallels here with fascism, I mean, the rise of fascism in both Italy and Germany and what is going on today, that one of the parallels is the extreme ineptitude, weakness, and betrayal of the closest equivalent to the Social Democrats that we have here, the Democratic Party, to the working class. I mean, they gave up on the working class 50 years ago. So it's like now, you know, why would we expect anybody to support them? I mean, it's a difficult, it's the same kind of situation where neither party has been successfully feeding the population of the country. And so neither one of them is particularly popular, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a giant issue. And also here, although we have the Left Party and it speaks out much more openly, the Green Party somewhat, but they're not like they are in the U.S. because once they were in the government here, they started saying, oh, let's do the Afghanistan war and this and that, you know, we don't really like some of the things. But the Social Democrats, some of them are left. They are supported by the working class. And the majority of them, for example, are against the weaponized drones. But the leadership, in that way, it's very much like the Democratic Party. The leadership might cave in on this thing, you know, and despite what the membership wants, you know. So it is a big problem. Well, I would say, just to summarize, I don't want to overstate. I believe we have a rising fascist movement in the U.S. We have it also throughout Europe. Interestingly enough, in Germany is about the 13th in order of how many fascists. So it has less fascists than Sweden, Switzerland, France, Italy, and so forth, which shows the level of historical depth that they went to some degree to examine and take responsibility for their history, which they have now, you probably know, right in Central Berlin, saying for the Jews, to take their history with regard to the Jews. And here's another example, but not necessarily with regard to the communists, not necessarily to the 20 million that were killed in the Soviet Union. It's a similar thing. It's easier to try to rectify what you did against the Jews than what you did against the communists or the working class movement. But I think it's so powerful that all of these statues are being, from Christopher Columbus through Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson at Princeton, he's not supposed to be anymore. I just feel that this is, the U.S. is also going through a moment of recognition, like Germany had to go through. To some degree, was even forced by the U.S. occupation to go through about what they did to Jews. And I find that's a very positive development. So,
yeah. And people are now talking about the stumbling stones, like something. I mean, it's now becoming another one of these fairly common mainstream media talking points, is people mentioning the stumbling stones that are all over the cities and towns in Germany, and how we could have similar memorials to genocide and slavery here.
We have also an interesting thing that could be repeated, which is in the district of Berlin called in Schöneberg in Bayreuther Platz. They have signs up which say the laws, like 1934, Jews may not walk their dog in the park. 19 whatever. And so you could also do that with the U.S. Probably in the north.
That would be very good.
More, but in the north also, just putting up little street signs like that, and that's an exhibit, you know. So,
yeah. And in many neighborhoods, such signs would also be extremely uncomfortable for the locals, because those segregated neighborhoods are often generally still segregated today.
Yeah. Well, Elsa, on the street, no blacks are allowed to buy houses in this neighborhood.
Yeah, know? That's right. Well, here in Oregon, that was true of the entire state.
Months, you know, you can have all the other years, and then you could put that. Yeah. In, you know. Yeah. I just moved back, so my head's about your size now, I think.
Oh yeah, right. I know. I'm often doing that too. Let's see. Can we make our heads the same size? Yeah. Elsa, it's been great having you on the show. Thanks so much for being my guest for the hour.
It's a whole hour. Wow.
Yeah, it's been an hour now.
I'm glad that you were able to let me babble on so long. I didn't know the interview would be so long. I was starting to say, uh-oh.
Oh no, that was great. I didn't let you babble. I was interrupting with pertinent questions every now and then. I think I was trying to anyway. I think it went very well.
But watch The Killing Floor, and don't think that only it's only for radicals and only for It's
actually, oh, no, everybody can see it.
It has Alfre Woodard. It has a brilliant performance by Damien Lee. We could have gotten Denzel Washington before he was famous, and we got Damien Lee. We thought he was far better for this role. Moses Gunn, different actors that are later became famous and that you were only in a bit role in our film. And it has reviews from Variety and Hollywood Reporter and the New York Times, the New Yorker, as a brilliant, entertaining film. Okay.
So, oh, absolutely.
Both reasons, you know.
Oh, okay. No, it's just great drama. It's you don't need to be a you don't need to be a radical.
I want to emphasize that it has both. Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah. Oh, yeah. As all good art does.
The actors, you know, who most of them came, as did Bill and the main writer, Leslie Lee, from the Negro Ensemble Company in New York, a play where actors and writers and directors were exploring Black history for a long time. So they have that. It's a really has a lot of roots, this film. Yeah. Mm. So, okay.
Yeah. Hope to see you in Berlin again some one of these years. Take care, yeah. Elsa.
You're not traveling now either, right? I would love to come to the States, but I can't, you know.
No, so, certain border issues currently and pandemic issues when it comes to actually playing in a little venue full of people. That's not happening.
I have many, many great friends, and I'm getting up in years, so I always want to see them.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know how long it would take. And, of course, if I fly there, then I also face coming back here where my family, my son is, and my partner and whatever. So it's like, yeah.
We'll see how it all works.
We hope it gets over, and or at least it gets enough in control that we'll meet again.
Hope so. Yes.
Okay, if not, care, this is a good second, actually, I have to say.
What's really that?
If we can't meet in person,
that's why I started doing these shows, you know, because
more often this way, because
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Take care, Elsa.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks for tuning into this conversation with Elsa Rosbach. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, soundcloud.com/davidrovix, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovix. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my Community Supported Art Program, or CSA, at davidrovix.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovix. If you're somewhere in the region of Portland, Oregon, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up for text notifications to be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response to help us mobilize against the coming waves of evictions. I've got a crowdfunder for an album project going, also known as a struggling gig economy worker employment scheme. You can check that out at davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. I'll do a live stream fundraiser for the album tomorrow, Saturday, July 25th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. GMT. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.